Hello, everyone. This is Eli Lake of the Washington Times, and I'm here today with Robert Farley of the Patterson School of Diplomacy at the University of Kentucky and also a contributor to the American Prospect. I should say I'm a contributing editor of the New Republic. How are you today, Robert?
I'm just fine. How are you doing?
I'm good. So you want to talk about Gaza?
Yeah. Let's talk some about Gaza.
All right.
We were just mentioning, or sort of part of the news of the day is the rejection. Sort of by both sides, although you know, there may be different levels of culpability in terms of the rejection of a Franco-Egyptian ceasefire proposal. The ceasefire proposal included something along the lines of international monitors along the border between Gaza and Egypt,
right,
which the point of which would be to eliminate the smuggling of rockets, not necessarily rockets because I think some of those are produced in Gaza, but more sophisticated military equipment from Egypt into Gaza, and presumably from countries more farther afield, such as Iran, into Gaza.
Yes. Well, I think that's enough. I mean, I think that's one of the red lines for the Israelis, as I understand it, is the an international presence to do a better job of the smuggling. And I realize I was on Blogging Heads about 2 weeks ago, and I was giving these sort of reasons for the Israeli thinking. But one thing I picked up from the Israeli side, and I've gotten kind of a half confirmation from my sources on the American side, is that there was a concern over the last 5 or 6 months that Hamas was increasing its rocket range, mm-hmm, capability with more sophisticated rockets than Qassams, the Grad, and there were some reports that they had even had access to the Fajr, which is a longer, I guess more longer range rocket from Iran. And the concern was that they could maybe hit the outskirts of Tel Aviv, and that they could not allow for this rocket capability sort of to continue. That's what I've gotten from sort of in Israeli intelligence circles. Now, when I ran this through traps on the American side, I got, it's true that there were more sophisticated rockets because the Qassams are fairly easy to assemble, as we both know.
Right.
But there was a concern, but the Fajr is not much of a confirmation on it. So that's where I'm at right now.
Right. And that's, I mean, that actually accords with some of the stuff I heard when I was in Israel, and they talked a lot of, mm-hmm, there was a lot of concern among the IDF people that we talked to there about not just the rockets that were falling now, but about future developing rocket capabilities from Hamas.
Right.
There was even some concern about, and I asked specifically about this because I'm, kind of interested in maritime affairs, about Hamas or somebody sneaking an anti-ship missile into Gaza, the same way that Hezbollah had developed an anti-ship capability and
right,
trying to blow up like an Israeli patrol boat or something along those lines.
Right.
Whether we can take, that's one potential reason for this, for why this is happening right now. I'm not necessarily more convinced.
Well, I think the immediate or proximate cause was that the Israelis feel that Hamas broke the ceasefire.
Right.
Hamas has a story about how they offered not to shoot a barrage or volleys of rockets into, mm-hmm, Israel if they completely opened up the borders, but... Mm-hmm. And people have raised this before, I guess, in the comments in the last dialogue I was in. But, I would just point out that the borders would be opened if Hamas did not count as one of its most important weapons, suicide bombers. I mean, it's just that that these things don't just happen out of thin air, So
sure, everything that happens has a very long history and a long...
But I'm torn because I'm one of these people who, coming more from the right, mm-hmm, I don't see the longer-term strategic goal of this. Of course, I think you'd have to be, just incredibly chastened not to feel for the residents of Gaza. And I'm not going to, couch that. Nobody likes to see dead children. You hate to see that, but I have to say that the alternative that I get from some of the critics here in America, mm-hmm, and of Israel's actions of, when you ask, if you press someone, you say, well, what should Israel do? And you say, well, you should try to negotiate a peace deal or something with Hamas. And I just think that's also insane. I actually wanted to go over Eli Lake's possible creative third ways out of this.
Why don't you go over that? Because I'm sort of in the... I won't say I'm exactly where you are, because I don't think... we get lost in all sorts of bizarre discussions of proportionality and so forth.
Sure.
The amount of damage that the rockets... As the rockets were actually doing damage from 2001 to 2008 is really... And, I, you know, I've been in places in Israel where rockets landed, so I do understand how more than just annoying it is to have rockets land in your backyard.
There's like a bunch of people who've displaced from their homes. They've just left Sderot. So, yeah, it's not the same as sort of an immediate casualty, but it's also a way of effectively, you know... Israel, the Israeli view is that we gave up Gaza, and now they want Sderot because they keep firing rockets and no one can live there.
You know, actually, and, I mean, we can either come back to that or we can talk about it now. It is the, and you know, again, I harken back to this experience that I had there 6 months ago. It is the Israeli view that we gave up Gaza, and so what do they complain about? And I guess that doesn't make any sense to me because it sort of assumes that Gazans don't care what goes on in the West Bank, right? That Gazans don't have any attachment to what goes on in the West Bank. And so that they don't perceive a sort of an interdependence of commitments there, right? So simply saying we gave up the settlements in Gaza, and that should be enough for the Gazans, assumes that there is no Palestinian national identity.
Well, no, but I don't necessarily. I mean, there was the Kadima Party had explicitly said they also wanted to get out of the West Bank. It explicitly endorsed this idea that Gaza was the first phase of this. It's unclear what Sharon would do because he was felled by the brain tumor, and it's hard to say. But we do know that his progeny, the Kadima Party, that has been ruling Israel until the rocket war really started, and really, I mean, I guess this policy window closed as a result of the Hezbollah-Lebanon war. Yeah. But until then... there was still this mainstream position that eventually Israel would prepare for disengagement as well from areas in Gaza. It would be maybe something around the land swaps of Taba, though it never got anywhere, obviously, because as soon as Israel leaves Gaza, you know, and rocket attacks intensify. I don't know. What do you do with that?
Right. Well, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, even to the extent that maybe I believe that Kadima wants this, you know, I know a little bit.
I don't think anyone in Kadima wants it. Now.
Right.
Everybody, the idea that Israel was just going to leave the territories, and I know that Daniel Levy thinks it's better to have negotiated the withdrawal, but I'm saying the idea that Israel was just going to sort of, you know, begin to sort of end all the entire occupation and so forth is pretty much over because, you know, the Islamic supremacists looked at it, saw it as an opening, you know?
Right. It's, I guess I can't say this word on Blogging Heads, but it's a big cluster. I guess I could say it on Blogging Heads.
You can say anything on Blogging Heads.
I suppose I can say anything on Blogging Heads.
There are no rules.
Right, exactly. I mean, I guess, but here's the thing. Even if I believe and that Kadima once wanted this, knowing what I know about Israeli politics and knowing what I know about Palestinian politics, I'm not sure if I were Palestinian that I would ever believe that that's what Kadima wanted or if that's something
that
Kadima could have said.
And that's perceptions among Palestinians is a very different issue.
Right.
Some of that is also due to the... there's been... have you ever watched Palestinian media? By the way, this is not true for Palestinian newspapers. Mm-hmm. There are some Palestinian newspapers that are very... very good, and there's, you know, and it's like all newspapers everywhere. But I'm saying, like, the Palestinian, like, you know, the PA television networks and stuff, there is also, you know, there's been quite an effort, and also in their educational materials, to, in some ways, I think Arafat deliberately was trying to poison his population to prepare them for the Second Intifada. There's enormous evidence to suggest this, that while Arafat was saying nice things in Western capitals, he was preparing his own people, not just through his speeches, but through his like entire control of the Palestinian Authority, to take a stab in the early aughts of the suicide bomber war, and that Second Intifada, and we still haven't gotten beyond that phase.
Right. I talked to Gershom Gorenberg a little bit about this, and he was of the attitude, and actually, that it's almost a mirror image, that both sides see each other as maximalist. And that in seeing each other as maximalists, they create the maximalism on the other side. They create groups with maximalist ends on the other side.
No, but that's just not true, because Gershom Gorenberg is a big deal in Israel. Mm-hmm. There's B'Tselem. There's all the entire post-Zionist movement. Mm-hmm. Israeli students were in the 70s taught a different version of Zionism, but it's nothing compared to what's taught, like, you know, in Palestinian textbooks, and that has begun to change. Now, I mean, Israel's not perfect. In fact, you know, Aaron Miller once had this expression that the treatment of the 1 million Arabs inside Israel is something equivalent to like a Jim Crow state in American history. But since Aaron Miller told me this comment, I remember it in 2002 in Jerusalem, you know, the Supreme Court of Israel and other institutions in that state have taken steps to try to make things better. But I'm just saying there is a large number of people in Israel who have, you know, not just the Israeli left. You know, for a while it was very much the Israeli center. And that nothing like that exists among the Palestinians. It's just, it's institutionally, it's not there. It's not, I mean, you can find people like Sari Nusseibeh, who I think, you know, are great on these things. And you can find individuals, but you can't really find any kind of political
movement. If this is all true, then what's the point of bombing the hell out of Hamas, right? I mean, if you're just...
Well, I don't agree with bombing them. I mean, I don't understand the strategic value of it, which gets us to...
Okay, I guess that takes us back to the same position here, that we don't understand the strategic value.
The creative solutions to the clusterfuck.
Right. We don't quite understand.
Would you like to... Can I throw a few...
Why don't you throw them out there? Why don't you go ahead? If you solve it here, this will be the most famous blogging
ever. Number one, I can't take credit for this. I have to... My old editor, Seth Lipsky, it's his idea. The Lipsky plan.
Okay.
Offer everybody in Gaza a visa and citizenship in the United States. Just see who volunteers. You want to live in Gaza or do you want to live in New Jersey?
Now, that's fascinating.
That's one idea. Now, I know you've got to work out a lot of details on that.
A few, yeah. I can
So that's just one thought. And, you know, I'm sort of semi-serious.
How about Alaska?
Totally
how about Alaska?
When he wrote that column in 89 for the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. But so that's one idea, is that just to say, you know, there should not just America, but, like, you know, if Western countries said, would you like to live in Gaza, mm-hmm. or would you like to live in Sweden?
Right.
Okay. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is for, and I've sort of said this, and I'm more serious about this, is that I'm starting to think that you need to have an Anbar model, maybe, mm-hmm. for Gaza,
mm-hmm.
and maybe for all the Palestinians, which is to say, we think that the Fatah party is there's two assumptions that I don't think are worth making, which is that Fatah is effective, mm-hmm. which I don't think is true. I think they're largely discredited. And two, that they would necessarily be good partners. And I think while I'm not questioning Abu Mazen, who bravely took on Arafat's suicide bomber strategy mm-hmm. in 2002, I just don't think he's got the political constituency at this point. And it's a very corrupt organization. And there are plenty of people in Fatah who really are not that different than their outlook on things and their use of terrorism and their sort of jihadism as mm-hmm. As Hamas.
Right.
So you need a third wave, and what you need is a political situation where Palestinians are simultaneously rejecting being kind of statelessness, which they obviously have to do, but also rejecting Hamas. So you need to have the double rejection, and you need to have it be a Palestinian transparent process. And that's how you accomplish the victory that Israel, if Israel were Ba'athists, if Israel were Nazis, if Israel were as bad as its critics said they were, then yes, it's possible to crush all of the Palestinians because they could kill hundreds of thousands of them and that probably would work. Mm-hmm. But Israel is not. It's a civilized country and it's never going to do that. So the idea that you can get a little bit violent, you know what I'm saying, and teach them a lesson is only going to, especially when you're dealing with an organization like Hamas, is only going to basically kind of redound for them as a symbolic victory, though I concede that, you know, I guess the infrastructure that they have in Gaza has been weakened. But, you know, I think that's only a temporary victory, and I think that Gaza exists largely as sort of a movement. And if you want to really defeat Gaza, Hamas, you need to get Palestinians to reject them.
Okay, can I comment on that?
Yes.
Now, I mean, it's actually pretty interesting to me because, as I understand it, part of the success of
Gaza
the
Awakening.
What's that?
Gaza Awakening.
Gaza Awakening. Yes. Part of the success of the Awakening strategy was the mobilization of, you know, tribal loyalties, but also sort of an Iraqi national loyalty against what was also an alien group, right? There were two alien groups competing for the loyalty of Iraqis. One of these was Al-Qaeda, and one of these was the United States. And the United States was able to make the case that they eventually, after, you know, sort of witnessing Al-Qaeda behavior for an extended period of time...
And also not practicing anything that resembles counterinsurgency for a while.
You were able to mobilize Iraqi nationalism to an extent and a number of other communal identities against this alien force. But I guess Hamas is not, whatever Hamas is, it's not really an alien force. And Fatah is not really an alien force in post-Palestinian life either. Not in the same sense that Al-Qaeda is, right? I mean, it's not something that was just introduced. I mean, you know, and Hamas has relationships with the Muslim Brotherhood and other things. But, you know, Hamas... Whatever it can do, it can also make a claim to being a legitimate representative of the Palestinian people in the way that Al-Qaeda could never make that claim in Iraq. And so it seems to me that it would be a good deal difficult, a good deal more difficult to mobilize communal identities against Hamas or Fatah, if you so chose, than it was to mobilize against Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And one more thing, you know, some people have been saying, and I guess maybe this is the upside, some people have been saying that that the destruction of Hamas would potentially open the door to groups like Al-Qaeda. So I guess that if you
open you're not going to destroy them this way.
Right. Well,
unless, as I said, the caveat is if Israel wants to become the monstrosity that, you know, European newspapers say they are, which they're not, then yeah, maybe that would work. But they're not. That's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I say this as an Ashkenazi American. I don't want it to happen.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's sort of like, you know, I think that the fact that the Israeli society is not coarse enough and has these institutions in it, whether they're political or cultural, that would prevent them from doing these kinds of things on the kind of grand scale that may make it effective, is one of the strengths of Israel, one of the things I like about Israel. Mm-hmm. But let's get back to alien Hamas, and I concede that Hamas has legitimate support among Palestinians, though I'm always of... This is the thing. Can I tell you what one of my big beefs, Farley, with you and Matt Duss is?
Sure.
Is that sometimes I think that you think political relationships are frozen in amber, and things can change.
Right.
And over time, and I think you can have... I don't understand why... I think a Palestinian could make the following argument to other Palestinians politically. What has Hamas... First of all, look at Hamas's charter. Hamas doesn't even want, like, the traditional kind of Palestine state. Yeah, they want to destroy Israel, but they are ultimately interested in, like, kind of a worldwide, the end of the line, a worldwide caliphate. Now, that's a tricky argument because on a local level, individual Hamas officials are more receptive to the local needs of the population than the gangster thieves of Hamas. This, and so, you know, in the context of, like, okay, you know, child abuser Arafat or, you know, who steals all your money and, like, makes you, you know, give up a daughter to get to build an addition on your home. These are real stories, by the way. Unbelievable corruption. All under the nose of the international community and the wonderful peace processors. But anyway, in that context, yes, Hamas had a great opening in order to build legitimacy. But look at what Hamas is standing for. Hamas is basically poisoning the children of Palestinians. And because I believe the Palestinians are no more or less human than Israelis or anybody else, mm-hmm. that at a certain point, I have to imagine there could be a movement of Palestinian mothers to be the counter to the mother of the three martyrs who ran in 2006, this famous woman who bragged the three of her sons became suicide bombers, and say, you know, we can no longer endorse a party that's killing us, that's destroying our future. I think that that could be a powerful slogan and a powerful platform. And second of all, I don't know this because there's not a lot of reliable reporting right now in Gaza, but I bet now that they have power, they are getting just as corrupt as a similar thing that happened in a place called Iran where, you know, at first the Islamic Republic of, you know, the Islamic Revolution, the Khomeinists and the followers of Khomeini had a lot more credibility than the corrupt, you know, people in the Shah. And then over time we've seen they have become torturers, they've running rackets, and they're just as rotten and probably worse than it was under the Shah.
So all the
benefit that you get from being out of power, now that they're in power and they aren't delivering anything,
right.
And I bet that they're getting more and more corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that yes, I concede, in 2006 Hamas had far more political support. And by the way, viewers, I'm sorry to kind of go on a rant here, but if you want to know how much power they have, the PLO and USAID couldn't even steal the election. That's how much support they had. Believe me, people were trying to steal that election.
Right. That's been an observation that's been made a long time. Why let them have an election if you can't steal it? And, you know,
that's a good thing about the fact that they had an election and now there's going to be another election. So there needs to be a strategy that's built around, well, first of all, there's supposed to be an election for Abu Mazen, he's going to lose. But there is a 2010 legislative election, which is a little bit more time. And that would be, I think, a useful thing for Obama to do as a U.S. policy, is to figure out how do we get a third-way movement here. And maybe that's not even for Obama. Maybe it's not for the United States. Maybe that's for, I don't know, the League of Arab Liberals. Maybe it's for European human rights organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody needs to go in there. Like, it can't be Israel, obviously, and it may not be able to be the United States because of its sordid history with the Fatah party.
Mm-hmm.
But someone needs to go in there and try to nurture and bolster and train and adopt a third alternative. Because as long as Hamas is in control, there will be no peace. Israel, and there will be nothing for Palestine.
And maybe you agree or disagree with this, and you know, I don't mean to speak for Matt here, but you know, my understanding, or at least I read this in several places, was that by most of the measures that we have, which of course you know are limited in Gaza, that there was some discontent, or there was rising discontent with Hamas about its inability to provide anything other than
guess
rockets.
What? By the way, that discontent is now support for Hamas, because I'm just going to go out on a limb here, Farley, but if you bomb a densely populated area, I bet the people getting bombed are going to go with the radical party.
That tends to be.
I'm not a political scientist. I'm not a pollster, but
you
know, I'm going to make that.
But it's shocking, actually. I mean, I don't think you need to be a political scientist or a pollster to believe that. But it's, I mean, you know my attitudes on air power anyway. But it is almost shocking the degree to which people believe that bombing will lead to moderation.
The idea is that bombing leads to submission. But in order to bomb to lead to submission, again, Israel has to be as awful as its critics say they are, which they aren't.
Right.
So, and my point here is also that now that we know that, now that that's out of the way, the only solution is a political solution, but not a political solution in an agreement between Israel and Hamas, because that's just never going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be a political solution of the Palestinian people throwing off the tyranny of Hamas.
Right. So you had a third solution.
Are we in agreement?
I don't think anybody, you know, I think it would be great if the Palestinian people threw off Hamas. I don't think Hamas is a partner for peace either. So,
But I think that's the only sensible solution. Creating a super envoy and having them, you know, meet with various Palestinians and getting pieces of paper and quartets and quintets and envoys and so forth. And parameters and frameworks. I don't think that's going to mean anything as long as the party of Far, the suicide bomber bunny, is still in power. They have to be extinguished in order for Israel to live and for Palestine to emerge.
Right. I guess we do agree it would be great if Hamas were overthrown.
It'd be great. It's a necessary condition for all of the goals that we share.
Is it absolutely? You know, now it's probably absolutely necessary. Was that true? Was that true 3 weeks ago? I'm not certain of that. You had a third proposal though, right? A third proposal. What did we get through all three, or was that?
No. Those were my two. The first one was not a serious offer. All the Palestinians or Gazans, at least, visas to America.
You see, again, I think if you change it to Alaska rather than New Jersey, then you have
they love
to
Alaska.
Talk about,
right? It's like instead of the Yiddish policeman's union, it's the Palestinian policeman's union.
I mean, it'll be it would be fascinating too to see how Sarah Palin would react to that in terms of building a new set of constituencies. Let me run something by you, and we talked a little bit about this before. People have been talking about the dog that didn't bark in this conflict, and it being Hezbollah, and why hasn't there been more activity from Hezbollah? And of course, yesterday or today, I forget which, there were three rockets launched from Lebanon, but they were not they were not, by all accounts, from Hezbollah. Hezbollah has made some aggressive statements, but hasn't actually done anything. So let me run a scenario by you. People talk a lot about how you need to fight until you can negotiate from a position of strength, right? So. People, and you know, I think it's actually historically justified to say that the 1973 war made peace between Egypt and Israel possible, because even though Egypt lost that war, it did well enough to present itself as a threat to Israel, right? And so to be able to say that we can negotiate, you know, not really from a position of strength and that we actually won the war, but from enough strength that we actually proved we can hurt you. And that was actually critical, not simply from a pride, but also from sort of demonstrating to Israel that Egypt could cause wounds.
I'm going to give you the counter to this.
Okay.
But I want to hear.
If we interpreted the 2006 war? I mean, the 2006 war is sort of widely interpreted as an Israeli defeat, which sort of makes sense when you assume when you actually assume the aims that Israel declared at various points of that during that conflict. But I think we can also agree that Hezbollah suffered terribly during that war. Hezbollah was badly wounded for whatever political gains that it won during the 2006 war. Right, it lost a lot of people, lost territory, et cetera, et cetera. It was able to spin it into a political victory almost in the same sense that Sadat was able to spin the 73 war into a political victory. And maybe Hezbollah not participating in this fight is the wage of that war, not in the sense that Israel has demonstrated to Hezbollah that Israel can punish Hezbollah, but rather that Hezbollah was able to demonstrate an ability to hurt Israel, but at the same time that it could be hurt itself. Right. In other words, so the war itself, by sort of creating something for Hezbollah, right, making Hezbollah capable of declaring a victory, made Hezbollah a slightly more responsible actor.
Well, let me address your points in the order in which you... First of all, on Egypt, I think 67 had more to do with it because 67 was the event that led to Sadat after Nasser. And while Sadat was not moderated until after 73, which is true, I think that you needed to get rid of Nasser in order to have a peace deal. And it's that was the key thing, and that Sadat was more obviously amenable to change. Now, interestingly, I spent a year in Egypt. If you ask, like, a lot of Egyptians, like, who do you like, Nasser or Sadat? And, like, we American, you know, foreign policy wonks, we always say Sadat was great. We need another Sadat. We always talk about how great Sadat is.
Right.
They hate Sadat. They think Nasser was the best. You know what I'm saying? So that's a side note. And then as for the 2006 war, I don't know that Hamas – I mean, Hezbollah is so much stronger domestically in Lebanon right now and has an effective veto over their politics. Now, it's hard to argue whether that is directly due to the 2006 war, but I would argue that the 2006 war – certainly didn't help, and
In the sense that it helped Hezbollah, though. But it didn't.
It helped Hezbollah politically in that sense.
Right.
And then finally, what's the end game on all of this? I mean, listen, did Hezbollah start the war because Iran happened to be before the UN Security Council, and this was like a distraction? I don't know the answer to that question. You'd have to eventually wait till the fall of the Islamic Republic and go through the archives, but. Though it is interesting, isn't it, that Larijani is meeting in Damascus with leaders of Hezbollah and Hamas today. But I would say, though, that I don't know necessarily that the only... I mean, was Hezbollah's longer-term strategic aim the ability to fire rockets at Israel with impunity, or was it to strengthen its political position within Lebanon so that it had an effective veto over the government there? And was the wider aim of Hezbollah to... You know, in some ways, ultimately, Hezbollah would benefit a great deal from an Iranian nuclear weapon because it would give them effectively a nuclear umbrella. So that while they may have to sort of have a hudna right now, if the Iranians did get a nuclear weapon, they could probably shoot more rockets and more deadly rockets and then have a degree of insurance to know that Israel really couldn't do much to stop them.
Okay. Well, I mean, for, you know, the political scientist in me is speaking up here, that even if we assume that Hezbollah and Hamas and Iran all have identical aims, there are still principal agent problems and a variety of other problems. But why
I'm uncomfortable with saying that Hezbollah or Hamas is controlled, like, in the traditional state sponsor model by Iran.
Mm-hmm.
I am uncomfortable with that. That I don't think is accurate. However, Iran does have a lot of influence, and I think that to a degree, even while they can be, to a certain degree, having independent agents, but they can also understand that the big piece of the puzzle here is that the mothership is once a nuke.
Sure, but
and in some
different Hamas and Hezbollah behavior here, right? I mean, if they're both sort of proxies of Iran, why is the one behaving in a manner that doesn't seem to help the other?
You mean the Hamas actions right now?
Right. Now, Hamas and Hezbollah. I mean, why isn't Hezbollah doing anything right now?
I see what you're saying. Right. Well, that's what I said. I'm not comfortable with the traditional state sponsor model.
Right.
I'm not. I mean, they're. I think that they're allies, but clearly Iran is the stronger party.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think that for the forces of, you know, for this axis, the most important front right now is the nuclear front.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Hamas
must know that they're not going to conquer Israel only with rockets. They know that. But, you know, over time, you know, if they get a nuclear umbrella, which is that's the real danger, then they're going to be able to do a lot more damage.
I mean, I guess, I'll just be straight out here. I think that's the notion that Iran would extend a nuclear umbrella to either Hamas or Hezbollah and that Israel would ever take that seriously, that anyone would take that seriously, strikes me as just a little bit absurd. I don't think the Israelis would ever take that seriously.
Iran, right now, a lot of people who want to sort of downplay the threat say, well, you know, they may be enriching uranium, but they're not at an HEU level yet, and, you know, who knows if they're going to use it, and, you know, Iran is more rational than the critics of Iran say.
Uh-huh.
But as soon as Iran gets a nuclear weapon, mark my words, I don't think they are going to do a first strike, but they're going to act like every other minute they might just change their mind, and they're going to continue to make... And when a leader of a country with a nuclear weapon makes the kind of speeches that Ahmadinejad does, it's a totally different issue. And second of all, the same peace camp right now that's saying, oh, they're reasonable, they're rational, they're this, they're that, are going to say you can't risk doing anything to the Iranians or anyone close to the Iranians because, you know, now they have nukes. And that's what happened, by the way, with the Soviets. Because the Soviets had nukes, the line from a lot of people, I mean, I never thought that a lot of the American left in the Cold War were necessarily pro-Soviet. Some of them were, but not all of them. And most of them weren't, obviously. But the argument that they made was that, you know, we had to continue to understand that anything that we did to provoke the Soviets could lead to a nuclear war.
And that argument wasn't taken seriously, right? There may have been people on the far left who was taken seriously.
We got engaged in wars
with Soviet client states, right? We went to war with Soviet client states on at least two occasions, right?
And Reagan went to war with Soviet client states, and look what happened.
Say that again?
Well, I'm saying that during détente, when that crowd was more in influence, the argument that you can't provoke the Soviets led to, you could argue, Soviets taking Afghanistan and the buildup of nuclear-tipped missiles in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, you could make that argument, but it doesn't make any sense to me.
You don't think that détente was a failed policy by 1979, 1980?
No, absolutely not.
You think that détente we could have just kept doing détente and we would have won the Cold War?
Yeah, no, I think that the Soviet Union would almost certainly have collapsed because of the drop in world oil prices in the 1980s.
I know about the drop in world oil prices
and not just the world oil prices, but because of greater stresses in the Soviet economy that were running all the way back to the 1960s.
I don't know. I just
we probably can't hash this all out in one block.
We didn't intend on having this argument, but I think that you can't say Reagan and the Reagan Doctrine had nothing to do with it.
Right.
I mean, you really think that?
Do I think that the Reagan Doctrine had anything to do with it? I guess I would say that if Jimmy Carter had won in 1980, and we're very far afield now. It's a bit of a difficult question because obviously Carter was taking a much more hard line on the Soviet Union by 1980 anyway, right? And so 1980 to 1984 would not have looked like 1977 to 1980, no matter who was president, because Carter was pursuing military...
Wasn't the lesson of détente, though, that like we were following the strictures of détente, but the Soviets weren't?
But I'm not convinced that that's true, really. I mean, I think the Soviet Union was a status quo power by the 1970s. But anyway...
Except when they invaded Afghanistan.
Okay. The United States has engaged in invasions of its neighbors and is still a status quo power, right? That in and of itself is not an indication of whether a country is a massive sort of global threat or not. Does our invasion of Panama in 1989 indicate that we're a revisionist power? No. I mean, no one would argue such.
Well, people have argued that because we invaded Iraq that we're... Well, okay.
Right.
I sort of see your point, but it's obviously a more nuanced issue, but to just sort of rule out that sort of countering the communists in Central America and Afghanistan and Angola and other places, and not to mention the kind of clandestine support and political support for Eastern European dissident movements and liberalization movements did not have some effect on...
We can also draw a line here. I mean, you know, I can in fact argue that support for Eastern European dissidents was a good thing and extremely helpful, and that, you know, massacring nuns in Guatemala was a bad thing and not helpful. So it's not all just one big tapestry. But anyway, do you want to talk about Panetta at all?
You want to quickly do Panetta?
Yeah, let's very quickly do Panetta.
Okay. Do you like him? Do you like that pick?
You know, I guess I do. I just don't know how I feel quite yet about the Panetta pick. Do I like him or not? I guess I like him. I guess I think he'll do fine. I guess that it would have been very difficult in this situation with Obama's base, which is motivated around this issue, to have any actual intelligence professional, anyone who was associated with the intelligence profession of the last 8 years, be director of the CIA, director of Central Intelligence.
God forbid the director of CIA should have intelligence experience. But everybody says now that Panetta has extensive national security, because being the chief of staff in the White House,
right,
you have the highest level clearances,
right,
and you're involved in national security. And he was also on the Iraq study group.
Right. It's not an absurd argument to say that Panetta has intelligence experience, but I think that
I think a chief of staff at the White House has, yeah, a lot of intelligence. I mean,
right, but he's not part of the intelligence community, right? And the intelligence community has its own way of approaching things, its own way of thinking about things.
Right.
I spoke to someone recently who made the argument that if what you want is a reboot of the CIA, if what you want is a reboot of the intelligence community, Panetta is absolutely the wrong kind of guy. That you needed someone in there who knew where the bodies were buried, who knew how to fight the fight on the terms that intelligence professionals understand and know how to fight, and that Panetta, as an alien in that, is simply not going to be able to do that. That he's not going to be able to. If what Obama wants is a reboot of the CIA, that's not going to happen under Panetta. Not going to happen under any outsider.
I don't think the CIA is very happy about this pick, and I think that they expected, for their loyal service to the Democrats during the Bush administration, like Paul Pillar and others,
mm-hmm,
that they would get to choose who would be their next director, who I think they wanted Steve Kappas.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard this indirectly, but I think that the reason one of the reasons they're bringing in Panetta is not just to appease the Glenn Greenwalds and Andrew Sullivans who supported them. I think it's really about the fact that once you have proven that you're willing to kind of try to directly undermine politically the White House, then even if you were doing that on side for the Democrats, that if you're smart and you're Obama's thinking maybe at some point I might disagree with my CIA,
mm-hmm, right,
then it would be good to have a guy like Panetta there. I think that's their logic on that. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that. I mean, it may end up being that Panetta is the DCI,
mm-hmm,
and that under Panetta is, you know, a bunch of CIA guys, and they really run the agency, and Panetta's kind of a figurehead.
Well, Kappas is going to be
that's a scenario that I've heard, and I think that that's a scenario that Dianne Feinstein very much favors.
Right.
So, you know, we'll see. But I think that there's a lesson in here for the CIA, which is that if you were going to try to take out that you might ingratiate yourself to Democrats on the Hill, but Democrats, the Democratic president is going to be very wary, even if at the time he agreed with you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it absolutely does.
You know what I mean?
Right, like
once you've proven your disobedience or disloyalty to the president, and the CIA has a relationship with the president,
mm-hmm,
that's different than like the Department of Labor,
right,
because the CIA is really is designed to do a couple things, but one of them is to every day present, or originally was to every day, now it's the Director of National Intelligence, was to present the president with his daily intelligence brief. And
I think what you're saying is that we have a multifaceted game that the CIA has to play here in terms, right, of where you have a situation in which the two parties are obviously in conflict, and the CIA has a preference between the two parties, and where you have executive and congressional power in conflict too, and the CIA probably has a preference there too, but that may run counter to their party preference right at this point, and so it is a difficult game for the CIA to play.
Now that said, I also feel in some ways for the CIA, like, I don't think they should be left holding the bag for things like extraordinary rendition or, you know, the detainee policies and,
mm-hmm,
so forth,
right,
and so on, in part because, A, the political leadership in those cases did ask them to do it, and, B, you know, some of these things were going on under Clinton and, you know, not a peep. So my sense on that is that, I mean, I'm somewhat torn, but I think that there is a kind of political lesson here, if any bureaucrats are watching Blogging Heads, which is that if you're going to shoot for the king, you better kill him. You better hope that Kerry gets elected in 2004, which he didn't.
Right, right. And
aim for the king, you better kill him.
Right, that creates sort of larger down the road problems if you fail. Yeah. I mean, I guess actually, we are sort of out of time right now.
Yeah, we are, and you're going to go watch Frost Nixon.
I'm going to go and watch Frost Nixon and see if
Hillary
gets any of these questions.
Nixon.
You know, I'm going for Nixon against type. I'm going against type right here, and I'm hoping that you know, he wins it in like the seventh in a technical knockout. That's what I'm calling.
I saw that movie, and I'm not going to give it away, but it's really good.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Eli. Oh, you know, one more thing. You know, we talked about Panetta, but obviously the more interesting and important nomination is that of Sanjay Gupta. Your immediate feelings on that we can sort of plow through quickly?
I have not given it. Does the Surgeon General do anything?
You know, that's really unclear. The only ones I remember
are...
But
see, now with socialized medicine and national health care, the Surgeon General is probably going to have a tremendous amount of power.
That's part of the question, and I think on the left, Gupta's views on that are in significant question.
What is Gupta's views? How does he offend the left?
There are two things. He brawled rather openly with Michael Moore. Moore actually got the better of them, but I think because Gupta didn't talk about the right things, that Gupta went after Moore on things that Moore was actually right about, rather than on some of the more serious problems that Sicko had. And that actually showed bad judgment on Gupta's part, because Moore really did get the better of him.
When I saw Sicko, I thought it was an autobiographical film.
See, there we go.
By Michael Moore. If he picked a fight with Michael Moore, then he's good in my book.
Right. And the other is the medical marijuana that he wrote an op-ed, I guess, in Time on against medical marijuana that wasn't really very well
thought. What was his argument?
His argument was that, you know, sure, it may help some people, but, you know, it's probably not really all that good for you in the long term if you smoke a lot of weed, which, you know, is an argument. It's not, we can't really pursue it all through. It's not really a very compelling argument against the legalization of marijuana. It's an argument that, you know, you shouldn't smoke pot all the time, I suppose.
Well, the best argument for legalizing marijuana is the government doesn't have a right to tell you what to do with yourself if you're an adult.
Right.
Which is, I never understood the argument from the marijuana lobby, which was like, if we legalize marijuana, we'll have much stronger ropes because hemp is so terrific. I'm like, no, just make the libertarian argument.
Right, argument is, and I rarely, rarely, rarely say this, the libertarian argument is much more compelling than the George Washington argument or whatever that we normally get. George Washington smoked weed.
So Gupta's a bit of a nanny stater, but, you know, he doesn't like Michael Moore, and, you know, for that we give him...
That makes him good in your book.
That's a B-.
Right. At best, I'm reserving judgment at this point. Anyway...
you're reserving judgment on everything.
What's that?
You think you're reserving judgment on Panetta? Is there anyone you really like? You like Michelle Flournoy for the Doug Feith job at Pentagon?
I do, actually.
Everyone likes her.
Yeah, everybody likes her. Anyway, we can talk about it later. We'll talk about it in other blogging heads. So
sounds good.
Anyway, good talking to Eli, and next time.
Good talking to you.
Until next time.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.